York. This is Democracy Now.
The need for an immediate, sustained ceasefire with the release of hostages. That would create space to surge more humanitarian assistance, to relieve the suffering of many people, and to build something more enduring.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in Israel as the U.S. for the first time introduces a U.N. Security Council resolution supporting a ceasefire in Gaza after months of vetoing other ceasefire calls. We'll get the latest and speak to a doctor just back from Gaza as the World Health Organization warns the looming famine is putting the future of a generation in peril. Then to the Goon Squad. Six white law enforcement officers in Mississippi have been sentenced to up to 40 years in prison for torturing two black men, Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker. One of the torture survivors will join us along with his attorney, Malik Shabazz.
This is a history-making moment. I'm just so sorry it had to come on the backs of the pain and the suffering, the torture and the shooting and the abuse and waterboarding of Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker, our clients.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's continuing its relentless assault on the Gaza Strip, with deaths reported earlier today in residential areas of Gaza City, Rafah and Khan Yunis. Meanwhile, the deadly raid on Al-Shifa Hospital is in its fifth day. Israeli soldiers have killed at least 140 people at Al-Shifa. Journalists and medical staff have been blindfolded and forced to strip naked. At least 13 patients have died in recent days due to a lack of medical treatment. Israeli forces ordered thousands of patients, staff, and displaced people sheltering at the hospital to evacuate as they threatened to blow up the entire facility. Families who were already displaced and are once again on the move described their brutal eviction from Al-Shifa.
We were surprised that at 2 a.m. there was shelling. The children were terrified. What more can I tell you? We stayed until the morning. We were not allowed to go down or up. They were calling with the loudspeakers from downstairs for men to prepare themselves, that the emergency team should prepare itself. The court outside with the bulldozers, the tanks, they turned things upside down. I don't know what more to tell you. The children were terrified. They turned things upside down in Al-Shifa, in the area of Al-Shifa. They didn't care about a child or a pregnant woman or youth or anything.
Al Jazeera has shared video that appears to show an Israeli drone targeting, then launching an air attack on a group of at least four unarmed civilians as they were walking in an open area of Khan Yunis in Gaza. One young man who survived the first bombing attempts to leave the scene before being killed in another strike. The shocking video is said to date back to February, but was released on Thursday. This all comes as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken held a meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Tel Aviv today and is meeting with other Israeli officials and the War Cabinet. The U.S. is now pushing for a ceasefire deal in exchange for the release of hostages. Blinken just wrapped up meetings with Arab leaders in Saudi Arabia and Cairo, Egypt, where he said, quote, children should not be dying of malnutrition in Gaza, adding, quote, 100% of the population of Gaza is experiencing severe levels of acute food insecurity, Blinken said. The head of Israel's Mossad spy agency is meeting with CIA Director William Burns and Egyptian counterparts for talks around ceasefire in Qatar. Meanwhile, over 70 former U.S. diplomats, government military officials have urged President Biden to warn Israel against building illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank and denying Palestinian rights. The officials, which include Clinton National Security Advisor Anthony Lake and other White House, Pentagon and State Department diplomats, say the U.S. should be prepared to withhold assistance to Israel. Israel's killed at least 430 Palestinians in the West Bank since October 7th, including 10 people Thursday alone. Among those killed yesterday was a 19-year-old teenager and a 63-year-old man who converted to Judaism but was reportedly, quote, mistakenly shot. Israeli forces have detained over 7,300 West Bank Palestinians since October 7th. UN officials continue to sound the alarm over the humanitarian crisis in Sudan, which they've described as one of the worst in recent history. The UN Security Council met Wednesday to discuss the conflict as it nears the one-year mark since fighting broke out between the Sudanese military and rival Rapid Support Forces. Edem Wasornu, the director of operations for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, warns Sudan is possibly on course to become the world's worst hunger crisis.
Malnutrition is soaring to alarming levels and is already claiming children's lives. A recent MSF report revealed that one child is dying every 2 hours in Zamzam camp in El Fasher, North Darfur. Our humanitarian partners estimate that in the coming weeks and months, somewhere in the region of around 222,000 children could die from malnutrition. And with the estimated, WHO estimates that more than 70% of health facilities are not functional.
In Haiti, armed groups have launched new attacks and blockades in the suburbs near Port-au-Prince, with multiple deaths reported. Haitian police say an operation killed the head of Delma 95, Ernst Julma, known as Tigre. Delma 95 is part of Jimmy Charissier's alliance of armed groups. The U.S. State Department Wednesday confirmed it had completed the first evacuation of more than 15 U.S. citizens from Port-au-Prince. Florida officials also chartered a plane to evacuate over a dozen residents of Florida from Haiti Wednesday. Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has warned he'll block the entry of undocumented Haitian immigrants into Florida and threatened to fly any undocumented Haitians who arrive in Florida to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. This comes as dozens of Congress members are urging the Biden administration to stop deportations to Haiti due to the worsening violence and instability and to extend temporary protected status, TPS, for Haitians. Over 70 Rohingya refugees are believed to be dead or missing after their boat capsized off the coast of Indonesia's Aceh province. At least 75 others have been rescued as of Friday. More than 2,300 Rohingya refugees fleeing persecution in Burma arrived in Indonesia last year, while hundreds of others have died or disappeared after attempting to leave Burma or Bangladesh. French lawmakers advanced a bill that seeks to rein in fast fashion's impact on the climate, labor rights, and the economy. The bill would ban certain ultra-fast fashion companies like Shein from advertising and penalize them by up to 10 euros per individual item of clothing. It also would force fast fashion retailers to include information on their products' reuse, repair, recycling, and environmental impact next to the product's price. This is French lawmaker Huguette
Fighting fast fashion means, first, protecting children living in other countries. It means preserving our biodiversity. It means preserving our French know-how. It means preserving our artisans who work hard day and night in our districts to create clothes that are sustainable and that comply with a minimum of environmental rules.
Russia launched a massive attack on Ukraine's energy system overnight, killing three people, leaving 1 million people without power. The attacks triggered a fire at the Dnipro hydroelectric station, cutting off power to the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, but authorities said there was no risk of a breach. This comes just one day after U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan visited Kiev, the Ukrainian capital. Back in the U.S., the Justice Department has filed a sweeping antitrust lawsuit against Apple, accusing the tech giant of orchestrating an illegal monopoly in the smartphone industry. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the suit Thursday.
Apple carries out its exclusionary anti-competitive conduct in two principal ways. First, Apple imposes contractual restrictions and fees that limit the features and functionality that developers can offer iPhone users. Second, Apple selectively restricts access to the points of connection between third-party apps and the iPhone's operating system, degrading the functionality of non-Apple apps and accessories. As a result, for most of the past 15 years, Apple has collected a tax in the form of a 30% commission on the price of any app downloaded from the App Store, as well as on in-app purchases.
In Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed a new law banning unhoused people from sleeping in public places such as parks and sidewalks. The law requires counties to establish temporary campsites if shelters are at maximum capacity. Under the law, individuals can sue a jurisdiction if they see people living on the streets. Housing advocates and other critics say the law does not effectively address the housing crisis or provide necessary funding and further marginalizes the already vulnerable unhoused population. Here in New York, home health aides are on a 5-day hunger strike, calling on the city to pass the No More 24 Act to put an end to 24-hour workdays. The majority of home health workers are women of color and immigrant women. Gui Hua Song from the Chinese Staff and Workers Association said, quote, working 24 hours a day for a long time, our bodies have been tortured, broken down, and full of aches and pains. We cannot care for our children and families. Many of our sisters' health is destroyed, and they, too, have become patients, they said. In more labor news, Georgia Republicans passed a bill that penalizes union-friendly employers. The legislation would bar workplaces that voluntarily recognize unions from receiving state subsidies. Republican Governor Brian Kemp backs the law, but it's expected to face tough legal challenges. The president of the AFL-CIO, Liz Schuler, called the measure appalling, adding that it, quote, violates long-held precedent established by the National Labor Relations Board. Act. And Senator Bernie Sanders and Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez reintroduced the Green New Deal for Public Housing Act this week to address the dual crises of climate change and unaffordable housing. This is AOC.
Green New Deal for public housing would immediately replenish the multi-billion dollar backlog for public housing repairs. It would repeal the Fair Cloth Amendment. It would invest up to $234 billion over 10 years to preserve, upgrade, and expand our public housing stock. It would bring public housing down to zero carbon emissions while creating 280,000 jobs in America. Yeah. It would end the era of government neglect, demolition, and privatization of our public housing stock. This bill also addresses unsustainable rent prices.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in Israel, where he just met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. This comes as the United States has introduced a U.N. Security Council resolution for a ceasefire in Gaza. Despite mounting international pressure, Israel's continuing its war on the besieged territory. The Israeli military raid on Al-Shifa, Gaza's largest hospital, has entered a fifth day. Hundreds of Palestinians have been reported killed or detained by Israeli forces. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to go ahead with an invasion of Rafah, where more than half of Gaza's entire population has sought refuge. Blinken spoke Thursday from Cairo, Egypt.
The need for an immediate, sustained ceasefire with the release of hostages. That would create space to surge more humanitarian assistance, to relieve the suffering of many people, and to build something more enduring.
A vote at the UN Security Council on the U.S. proposal could come as early as today, but the language of the resolution has been criticized for not going far enough. A group of non-permanent members of the UN Security Council has drafted a separate resolution calling for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. Up until now, the U.S. has repeatedly blocked calls for a Gaza ceasefire. On Thursday, Blinken also spoke about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
Children should not be dying of malnutrition in Gaza or anywhere else for that matter. 100% of the population of Gaza is experiencing severe levels of acute food insecurity. We cannot, we must not allow that to continue.
Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She also serves as an international advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace. Her new article in The Hill is titled, Gaza Shows Food Airdrops Often Take Lives Instead of Saving Them. She also recently wrote a piece for Al Jazeera headlined, What Lies Behind the Biden Administration's Changing Ceasefire Language. Well, let's start there. Phyllis, if you can talk about about what the U.S. has introduced into the U.N. Security Council. It could be voted on today. And it also what could be voted on are the is the resolution that has been adopted by or sponsored by eight of the elected members of the Security Council.
Thanks, Amy. You know, what we're looking at here is a lot of playing with words. What is different is the language of the Biden administration. We heard it yesterday from Secretary of State Blinken. We're hearing it from President Biden. We're hearing it from others using the word ceasefire, saying immediate ceasefire in some cases. We're seeing the New York Times is saying that the U.S. is introducing a resolution at the Security Council calling for an immediate ceasefire. That's not the case. What the U.S. resolution calls for, and we should be clear, there has not been a formal distribution of what the U.S. is actually going to put on the table for the vote this morning. There's at least three different versions circulating around, but they're all about the same on the critical description. It's in the first paragraph, the first operative paragraph of the resolution, uses the language of an immediate ceasefire, but it doesn't actually call for a ceasefire. What it does is recognize the importance of a ceasefire and then says, and therefore we should support the negotiations that are underway in Doha, in Qatar. These are the negotiations that have been underway for weeks. They are mainly focused on the release of hostages, as well as the parameters of a short-term ceasefire, probably 6 weeks. But the key thing is that the U.S. draft does not call for an actual Security Council call for a ceasefire. The language of the eight of the 10 elected members of the Security Council is much simpler and much more direct. It says explicitly that that the Security Council demands an immediate ceasefire respected by all parties leading to a sustainable ceasefire. Period, full stop. The U.S. language is very convoluted. It's various versions of the Security Council determines the imperative of an immediate and sustained ceasefire to protect civilians on all sides, and then says something about, and therefore we unequivocally support the negotiations that are underway. So it takes all of the authority out of the Security Council, makes the Council into essentially a group of cheerleaders for the existing negotiations that are underway, and takes away any additional pressure that an actual Security Council demand for an immediate ceasefire would have. Because Security Council resolutions, as you know, Amy, and I think most of our listeners know, is part of international law. It's enforceable. It doesn't mean that it would be enforced, but it's a very powerful signal, something that an acknowledgement of the importance of a ceasefire is simply not that. It's not that.
Do you think that the United States introduced this ceasefire resolution because the group of eight of the unelected members of the Security Council are introducing their resolution? And if that went forward, could the U.S. afford to veto it?
I think that the U.S. resolution has been in preparation for quite some time. The resolution by the eight of the 10 elected members is a new development. This emerged only in the last several days. So I don't think it's directly in response to that. It is clearly in response to the massive escalation of political pressure, both from governments and from civil society, certainly here in the United States, but also around the world, where there is demand, there is outrage at the United States' position at the United Nations, which has been a consistent pattern that's gone on for months now, of vetoing in the Security Council any calls for a ceasefire and voting against it in the General Assembly, where it has no veto, and using pressure, economic pressure, political pressure, on other countries to encourage or in some cases really pressure them to vote against these resolutions. There is outrage growing, and the U.S. government and the Biden administration in particular is very, very isolated as a result. Here in the United States, we're seeing a huge escalation in the opposition to the Biden administration insistence on continuing to support Israel, sending military aid, despite the change in language, the recognition of famine that we just heard again from Secretary of State Blinken.
the recognition of the humanitarian crisis that is killing people in the level of hundreds every day. And when we're hearing from the humanitarian experts that the level of famine is at 55% of the entire population of northern Gaza right now, is at the highest possible level of absolute famine, which means, Amy, that even if food began to be delivered on a large scale today, probably hundreds, maybe even thousands of the most vulnerable people, primarily babies and children and the elderly, would be at risk of dying because their bodies have been so undermined, so destroyed by the lack of food and water for so long. So we're dealing with an absolute crisis, an absolute human catastrophic crisis. And what we're hearing is wordplay at the United Nations. How can we use the language of ceasefire so that everybody says, oh, they're calling for a ceasefire, without calling for the ceasefire?
This is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking to the Israeli parliament Tuesday about plans to invade Rafah, again, where more than half of Gaza's entire population has sought refuge.
We, of course, share this desire to allow an orderly exit of the population from Rafah and the provision of humanitarian aid to civilian population. We have been doing this since the beginning of the war, but I made it clear to the President Joe Biden in our conversation that we are determined to complete the elimination of Hamas battalions in Rafah, and there is no other way to do it except by going in on the ground.
So there he's speaking to the Israeli parliament. He also addressed Republicans in a closed-door session, and there's a question whether the House Speaker will be inviting him to address a joint session of Congress. Phyllis Bennis, if you can talk about what Netanyahu is doing, the significance of the calls for there to be new elections by none other than the majority leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, a real change from the way he has embraced the Israeli leadership?
You know, Amy, this is something that has a long history in the United States. Over the last 15 years or so, there's been a significant shift in how support for the longstanding U.S. support for Israeli military, its military support, its economic support, its political and diplomatic support, how all of that shakes out in Washington. It's become a much more partisan issue, something that that groups like AIPAC and other parts of the pro-Israel lobby have always wanted to avoid. They always wanted it to be a bipartisan consensus to support Israel. And it no longer is. The polls have been showing that for years now, that there's a massive shift underway. It's particularly generational, but it's also between parties, where on the Democratic Party side, support for Israel has diminished profoundly. And on the Republican side, it's been a complete embrace of all things Israel. What we're seeing now is a continuation of that, certainly, with the Republican leadership in the House of Representatives following what happened in 2015, when the Republican leadership in the House at that time invited Netanyahu, who was the prime minister then as well, to address a joint session of Congress in order to pressure President Obama and oppose the Iran nuclear deal that was then being discussed. And it was one of these things that was diplomatically outrageous. It had never happened before. There was no consultation with the White House. Usually when a head of state comes, they're invited by the president. Not this time. Netanyahu ignored the White House, came at the invitation of the Republican leadership of the House, and gave what amounted to a campaign speech in the U.S. Capitol, as if it was his own capital, calling on the members of Congress to vote against their own president in the interest of his country. And in response, over 60 members, mainly of the progressive and especially the Black Caucus of the Congress, protesting the racism of Netanyahu towards President Obama, boycotted the speech, something that had never happened before. We're seeing essentially a repeat of that now, where he is emerging as a partner of the Republican opposition that is demanding more support for Israel, more money for Israel, more arms for Israel, at a time when the Biden administration itself, despite its change of language, is continuing to send more weapons and more money, trying to get Congress to approve $14 billion more in military aid to Israel without any conditions, in violation of U.S. law. And what we're seeing is a real shift on the political parameters. You mentioned earlier the diplomats and former military leaders in the United States who are calling for a reevaluation of the U.S. aid to Israel, saying that it must be conditional. It must not continue at this level. And we're seeing that coming from all kinds of new places, from funders of the Biden campaign. The pressure is mounting in ways that I've certainly never seen in decades of doing work on this
issue.
I wanted
to quote from the over 100 Democratic donors and activists who've written President Biden's campaign, warning the president's support for Israel's assault could cost him the election, saying, quote, because of the disillusionment of a critical portion of the Democratic coalition, the Gaza war is increasing the chances of a Trump victory. You have former diplomats, people from the Pentagon, the State Department, the White House, like Clinton's National Security Advisor Anthony Lake, you know, deep establishment people saying that this has to change. Yet President Biden seems to be, to say the least, dragging his feet on this. The whole
Absolutely.
Issue of weapons, sending weapons to Israel. We just learned in that Washington Post expose over 100 shipments of weapons through this time, just under the threshold where it would have to be approved by Congress. We're wrapping up, Phyllis, and then we're going to talk to a doctor who particularly deals with child nutrition and hunger in Gaza. She just got out of Gaza. But we want to have your final comment on what this would mean. Yet at the same time, you have senators like Van Hollen, Merkley, both went to Rafah, and others who are saying, cut the weapons sales.
It's crucial that the weapons sales be cut. One of the things I just want to point out in the last moments, this issue of Chuck Schumer coming out against Netanyahu, there's a move to isolate Prime Minister Netanyahu right now. And it's certainly appropriate. Part of the reason he's still in power is to stay out of jail. It's a very personal crusade on his part. But we have to be very clear that the people who are likely to replace him, if he were to either resign or be recalled in an election, they all support this war. So we should not have the illusion that I'm afraid people like Chuck Schumer and others might have that anybody who's not Netanyahu should be and would be welcomed with open arms in Washington with more weapons, more hundreds of smaller weapons shipments that wouldn't necessarily have to be approved by Congress. This is a very dangerous reality. We have to be very clear that this is a systemic decision by the Israeli leadership. This is not a one-man show in this horrific genocidal war that is being waged in Gaza. And we have to be careful not to fall into that trap of putting it all on one person and thinking that if one person is replaced, somehow that's an answer.
Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, serves as international advisor for Jewish Voice for Peace. We'll link to your articles in The Hill and Al Jazeera. This is Democracy Now. When we come back, we speak to a doctor just out of Gaza. Stay with us.
يلّا اتنين مريمة يلّا يجي هالنوم يلّا تحب الصلاة يلّا تحب الصوم يلّا تجي هالعوافي كل يوم بيوم يلا تنام يلا تنام لا تبح لا طير الحمام روح يا حمام لا
Go to sleep, Rima, by Feruz. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our coverage of Israel's war on Gaza, the World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warned Thursday the future of an entire generation of Palestinians is in serious peril.
On Tuesday, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Partnership said that Gaza faces imminent famine because so little food has been allowed in. Up to 16% of children under 5 in northern Gaza are now malnourished, compared with less than 1% before the conflict began. Virtually all households are already skipping meals every day, and adults are reducing their meals so children can eat. Children are dying from the combined effects of malnutrition and disease and lack of adequate water and sanitation. The future of an entire generation is in serious peril.
We're joined now by Dr. Nahreen Ahmed. She's a pulmonary and critical care doctor based in Philadelphia, the medical director of the medical humanitarian aid group MedGlobal. Her first medical mission to Gaza was January. Earlier this month, she returned to Gaza, where she volunteered for 2 weeks. She left on Wednesday and is joining us now from Gaziantep, Turkey. Dr. Ahmed, thanks so much for being with us as you've just come out of Gaza. Talk about what you've seen in terms of child hunger.
Yeah, thank you for having me and for this opportunity to speak about what's going on. This was, as you mentioned, my second trip back, and it was pretty clear how rapidly the malnutrition has risen in Gaza. I had the ability to actually go and see what was happening in the north as well. I'll start with what's happening in the south. MedGlobal has a stabilization center that's in the south of Gaza that is purely to treat malnutrition. So the situation is so bad that there needs to be specific centers that are primarily treating patients with malnutrition. As was mentioned before in the broadcast, the most vulnerable population here are children under five, but we are also seeing that pregnant and lactating women are suffering from this as well, and there's a rapid increase in malnutrition across mothers as well. You can imagine that these two things are connected, as children under five or newborn babies are receiving nutrition from their parents, from their mother. And with the fact that mothers are also experiencing malnutrition, we're seeing that newborn babies are being born at an astoundingly low weight. Infections are happening very rapidly at these young ages as a consequence. And again, mothers are going through the mental health crisis of experiencing the inability to feed their children because of their own level of malnutrition. The percentages of malnutrition from when I went in January to when I just returned now have doubled. That's in practically a month's time. And as was already mentioned, this situation is happening so rapidly that even if aid was increased tomorrow, we would still be in a severe situation where the amount of food would just not be enough in the immediate term. And so this is what I unfortunately witnessed with my own eyes. Hmm.
And can you talk about what it means when children in incubators, when little older children experience malnutrition, how they are able to cope if they get some kind of aid, they go out of the hospital, being more vulnerable and especially in the, to say the least, extremely harsh conditions now of Gaza?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, thinking about this, first of all, this is not just a problem that's solved by, you know, the nutrition therapeutic feedings that we're giving. This is a cyclical problem that, first of all, one, it's very painful. A child suffering from hunger, this is an extremely painful thing to experience. Two, the access to food once somebody is released from an inpatient unit is still going to be a problem. We see children chasing after trucks where food distribution is happening. We see children chasing with water bottles. To the water distribution trucks, I mean, this is a situation that is also degrading for them to have to experience finding food and water in this way. Lastly, you know, when we talk about vulnerability, we're talking about vulnerability to infections. This is what we're seeing the most in a hospital in the north of Gaza, where almost every single patient that I saw in the inpatient pediatrics unit was suffering from malnutrition. Each of these children had an infectious complication. Either they were suffering from liver disease, from rampant hepatitis A, from lack of access to clean water, or they had severe pneumonias that they were even more vulnerable to complications of because of the level of malnutrition. Or, you know, diarrheal diseases that were happening for the same reasons. And so children are dying from infectious processes as well, the complications of having severe malnutrition. All of these issues are preventable. All of these issues are preventable.
I want to turn to Halash Rafdib, a Palestinian who has nothing to feed her children.
What has this child done to suffer from hunger? I cannot find milk for 5 shekels or a packet of milk from the agency. There, the normal milk is for 150. There is no work. There is no food, no drinks. We are eating plants. We started eating pigeon food, donkey food. We are like animals.
That is a Palestinian mother in Gaza. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, is calling the situation in northern Gaza beyond desperate. Maybe that's why the Israeli government wants them to be to lose all their funding. The most comprehensive agency for Palestinians there in Gaza. In a post on X, UNRWA said its staff visited Kamal Adwan Hospital and fuel and medical supplies were delivered, but aid is just a trickle. Food needs to reach the north now to avert famine, UNRWA said. You went to that hospital. Can you describe also the difference between January and now? And what about the doctors and the medical staff? How are they dealing with all of this? I think we just lost Dr. Nahrin Ahmed, so we're going to go to a break and see if we can get her back. Dr. Nahrin Ahmed is a pulmonary and critical care doctor based in Philadelphia, medical director of the medical humanitarian aid group Med Global. She just got out of Gaza and is speaking to us from Gaziantep, Turkey. Back in a minute.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Lurleen Wallace has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Can't you see it? I know you can feel it. All in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama has got me so upset, and Memphis has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Hound dogs on my trail, little school children sitting in jail, black cat crossed my path.
Nina Simone singing Mississippi Goddamn. In a moment, we're going to go to Mississippi, where a so-called goon squad, self-described of police officers and sheriff deputies, have just been sentenced to years in prison for torturing their victims. But we're going to see if we can now resume our contact with the doctor just out of Gaza. But first, we're going to keep looking at the looming famine there. This is Amber Alayan with Médecins Sans Frontières, that's Doctors Without Borders, speaking at the United Nations on Tuesday.
The hospitals rely on quota systems for how many drugs they keep in their pharmacies and their stocks in each department, and they have to choose between whether do I fully stock my operating theater, my ICU, or my emergency room. And this is where you have doctors faced with horrific decisions of having to intubate and amputate children and adults without anesthetics in emergency rooms. Part of the reason for this is the lack of medications or the lack of medications accessible at that time. Part of the reason is that we have internally displaced people living in hospitals, sheltering in hospitals because they have nowhere safe to go. And what that means is they are staying in hospital beds. So what does that mean for injured people? They arrive, they get a quick and dirty surgery in an emergency room or in an operating theater, and they have nowhere to be hospitalized afterward. Or when they are lost all throughout the hospital, and our teams spend all day searching for the patient that they just operated on 12 hours before. What does this mean over the long run? The longer this war goes on, the longer these wounds have to rot, and I mean really rot. The infections are getting worse and worse, and it's horrific. It's horrific for our providers, and it's absolutely horrific for these patients.
Dr. Amber Alayan is with Doctors Without Borders. She went on to describe how the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is impacting women and children.
Two populations are particularly vulnerable: pregnant and lactating women, who were already facing iron deficiency anemia before the war, which puts them at risk for hemorrhage during birth. with the war, it puts them in a state of undernourishment or malnutrition, potentially malnutrition, which means that they can't breastfeed their children properly. The milk doesn't necessarily come in, and it's definitely not enough. And the other population is children under 2 years, which is the breastfeeding age. There's not enough space for us to work closely with the mothers to help them start lactating again. We can't even access them. And to be able to do that, you have to have day-to-day activities with those women, and that is not something that's possible for us right now. Those children need to be breastfed. If they can't be breastfed, they need formula. To have formula, you need clean water. None of these things are possible. What we're talking about is women who are squeezing fruits, dates into handkerchiefs, into tissues, and drip feeding their children with some sort of sugary substance to nourish them.
Dr. Amber Alayan of Medecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, speaking at the United Nations on Tuesday. We're rejoined with Dr. Nafrin Ahmed, pulmonary and critical care doctor based in Philadelphia, just out of Gaza on Wednesday. She's speaking to us from Gaziantep, Turkey. If you could go on to talk about, Dr. Ahmed, the mental health situation of the people in Gaza, particularly children.
Yeah, the mental health situation is devastating. Pre-war, 50% of Gazan children were experiencing some PTSD from prior conflicts. It's important for us to remember that this is not the first time that they've experienced this kind of trauma. Given that 50% of children were experiencing that, we're up to probably 100%, presumably, of children who are experiencing trauma based on the day-to-day proximity to missile strikes and experiencing what they're experiencing. Our team that went with me this last week in a collaboration with an organization called MeWe International, we actually went to several of our medical access points in shelters across Rafah. And we spoke to women and children about what they're experiencing and initiated a community-based approach towards providing mental health support. And this was using things like music, activity, very low cost because it's so hard to get supplies or, you know, when it comes to mental health, you know, we're not just talking about medications, we're talking about the ability to give agency and a voice and empowerment back to people. And what we heard was the amount of children just unable to dream. That's what the first thing they tell us, that we have no dreams. We used to have dreams. We have no dreams. We cannot imagine that our lives will ever go back to normal. We've heard children say, I just want to go home. I want to be back in the safety of my home. In an exercise that we did with a group of women and children, and this was mothers and their children, caregivers and their children, the number one thing when asked for people to think, for them to think about a positive, something positive that they could hold on to, they would draw a picture of them returning to their home. This was overwhelmingly the number one thing. And most of these children have been displaced more than one time. And they just talk about how much they miss their home, how much they miss playtime, activities, playing with children, going to school. We met so many children and adolescents who just wanted to be back in school. They're missing that opportunity to have any kind of intellectual stimulation. And it's causing a great deal of depression, anxiety, and just absolute a horrific experience for all involved.
Ahmed, we thank you so much for being with us. Dr. Nafrin Ahmed is a pulmonary and critical care doctor based in Philadelphia with the group Med Global. She's medical director of the Medical Humanitarian Aid Group. Her first medical mission to Gaza was January. She just left Gaza on Wednesday, speaking to us from Gaziantep, Turkey. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Mississippi, where six former law enforcement officers have been sentenced to between 10 and 40 years in prison each for raiding a home and torturing two black men. The officers, all of whom are white, belong to a group that described itself as the Goon Squad. In January of 2023, the six officers burst into a home, then beat, handcuffed, waterboarded, and tasered Michael Corey, Jenkins, and Eddie Terrell Parker. The officers also sexually abused them with an object while shouting racial slurs. One of the officers put a gun in Jenkins' mouth for a mock execution and pulled the trigger. The bullet lacerated his tongue, broke his jaw, exited through his neck. The officers then planted drugs at the scene in an attempt to cover up their act. The attack occurred in the majority white Rankin County, which is about 20 miles away from majority black Jackson, Mississippi. Some of the officers were also sentenced for their role in a separate assault just 2 weeks earlier, when another member of the goon squad repeatedly tased a man and put his genitals in his mouth. While the charges focused on these two cases, the New York Times and Mississippi Today have revealed that deputies in the Rankin County Sheriff's Department have for decades barged into homes, handcuffed people, tortured them for information or confessions. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland issued a statement Thursday saying, quote, the depravity of the crimes committed by these defendants cannot be overstated, and they will now spend between 10 and 40 years in prison for their heinous attack on citizens they had sworn to protect, AG Merrick Garland said. We go now to Jackson, Mississippi, where we're joined by Eddie Parker, as well as his attorney, Malik Shabazz, who is with Black Lawyers for Justice. Malik Shabazz, let's begin with you. Can you talk about the courtroom scene and the sentencing of these sheriff's deputies and police officers for what they did?
Good morning to the Democracy Now! Audience and Ms. Goodman. The scene inside of this courtroom in the United States District Court for the sentencing of the Goon Squad was absolutely incredible, and you wouldn't believe it if it was a movie. I mean, to see the big, bad, intimidating, murderous Goon Squad, to see all of them there, to see all of them in court, crying tears out of their eyes and begging the judge, begging Eddie and Michael in this packed room was absolutely incredible. But it was well deserved because so many other families and victims have had to shed those tears and go to jail for a long time behind their crimes and lies. I mean, Amy, it was absolutely incredible. And never have we seen this many police officers sentenced to this kind of time in 1 week, and it was awesome.
Malik Shabazz, talk about how this self-described goon squad operated.
Okay. Well, they operate worse than criminals. I mean, they handcuff people. They like they did to Eddie. When they handcuff, they don't use warrants. They beat. They tase. They take their private parts out of their pants on another victim. They use dildos on Eddie and Michael. At least attempted to use them on Eddie and Michael. They waterboard like U.S. troops did in Iraq. They put guns to heads, guns in mouths. They shoot in mouths. I mean, they are everything that you have ever heard that police may do, they did. They throw down guns. They carry throw down guns. They plant guns. They steal videotapes. And this is why they have received the longest and strongest sentences for any police brutality case in the history of the United States of America and even the world. This week, the 132 years given to the Goon Squad defendants represent the longest criminal sentences ever given out collectively and individually to police officers in the history of the United States of America. And they deserve every day and an hour of it.
Eddie Terrell Parker, your feelings in the courtroom after having been so seriously brutalized and tortured to see these officers put away for years.
It was a moment in history. I mean, it was satisfying. I enjoyed every second of seeing and watching it all, you know, come to a reality.
I wanted to turn to Michael Jenkins' mother, Mary Jenkins, who earlier in the week spoke outside the federal courthouse in Jackson, Mississippi.
When I first found out that my son was shot and that he was shot in the mouth, I was almost certain that he was dead. I called Rankin County, and at first they wouldn't let me speak with anyone. They said they were in a meeting. And when I finally spoke with someone, I asked him if my son was alive. And he said, as far as I know. I said, well, when can I see him? He said, when we let you see him. This is a crying mother on the phone trying to inquire about her son. He said, Michael is our property. That's what that deputy told me on the phone. My son shot in the mouth, and he's telling me that Michael is their property.
That's Mary Jenkins, Michael Corey Jenkins' mother. Malik Shabazz, will Michael Corey Jenkins and Eddie Terrell Parker also civilly sue for not only personally these men, but clearly one of the things that their lawyers argued, the lawyers for the sheriff's deputies and the officers, is that there was this permissive atmosphere that allowed them to operate in this way. Will they be suing the state or the city?
No, we are suing Rankin County and its board of supervisors and Sheriff Brian Bailey, who was supposed to be running a department that supervised and monitored its officers. Unfortunately, during the sentencing hearings, it came out that Brett McAlpin, who is the chief investigative officer, which is similar to internal affairs, the criminals ran the department in Rankin. And that's why they are facing a very large civil judgment and civil trial in this case. This is a pattern and practice of the Rankin County Police Department to routinely ignore constitutional right violations. I want to say one thing, and then I want you to hear from Mississippi Attorney Trent Walker. He's with me. He's from Rankin. But Eddie Terrell Parker gave the most powerful victims testimony in these 3 days of sentencing these six defendants. He was very powerful. Mr. Mel Jenkins, Michael Jenkins' father, were very influential in these hearings. But I would like you to hear a further answer on your question from Mississippi Attorney Trent Walker, who's from Rankin County. Here he is.
Good morning.
Hi, Trent Walker.
Hello.
If you can... Go ahead. If you can talk about the significance of what's happened, and does this open up hundreds of cases going back decades?
It should open up hundreds of cases going back decades. Anything that these six have touched, in point of fact, given the testimony that they themselves gave, and they use terms like there was a culture of violence. More than one of them said that, and that violence and brutality was expected for you to work on the night shift, which they did not refer to as the night shift. They talked about it as the goon squad shift. And so, yes, anything that they touch should go back, be reexamined, and really just as a matter of course, overturn, because when you find that they're willing to plant evidence and falsify reports, you know, they had Michael Jenkins charged with aggravated assault on a police officer and with possession of drugs. Michael could have been sentenced to up to 38 years in prison. And as a criminal law practitioner in Rankin County, I can tell you, he would not have been slapped on the wrist, and he would have served many years in prison for those charges that they falsified and put on him.
I want to go to U.S. Attorney Darren Lamarck, speaking last year, announcing the federal charges against the former officers for the attack.
These defendants committed heinous acts of violence against handcuffed victims, whom they terrorized under color of law. As reflected in the information unsealed today, these men sexually abused their victims, repeatedly tased them, tortured them, all under the authority of the badge, which they disgraced. But not only did they brazenly commit these acts, but after inflicting serious bodily injury by firing a shot through one of the victim's mouths, They left him lying in a pool of blood. Gathered on the porch of the house to discuss how to cover it up. What indifference. What disregard for life.
So I'm wondering if either Trent Walker or Malcolm Shabazz can, Malik Shabazz, can talk about the state charges, also federal charges, what this means. We're talking about officer sentence, not only for the attack that we're describing today on Michael Corey Jenkins and Eddie Terrell Parker, but for 2 weeks before when they barged into someone's home. I think this was Deadman. And how has he been described? The judge said he committed the most shocking, brutal, and cruel acts imaginable. Attorney Shabazz, you've described Deadman as oppressive and sick. Talk about these acts that you know about that they did, that they were sentenced for in addition to the case of Michael and Eddie.
Well, about a month before, they had targeted a person named Adam Schmidt. And Adam Schmidt allegedly had offended Deadman because he had allegedly stolen something from one of Deadman's friends. So the Goon Squad gangsters, they had his tag and they had the tag tracers and they had an order out. They had an order out that if they found him driving anywhere without any probable cause to stop him, that they were going to stop him and deal with him. They found him one night. They called Deadman, who came off duty, on duty. And then Deadman, who was on this night shift. Now, I want to remind you that according to the sentencing hearings, you could not work the night shift in Rankin County Sheriff's Department without being a part of the Goon Squad. And overall, you could not rise or be promoted into the Rankin County Sheriff's Department without participating in violence and being violent at night with the Goon Squad. And every one of the defendants said that they were doing okay in their careers until they were inducted into this gang called the Goon Squad. Okay, so Deadman himself, it's so much sickness here, but any officer who you see that will whip out his private parts and attempt to put it in the mouth of a defendant
on the side of the road,
take his gun out, shoot it by the side of his head to make him believe he's going to be killed, pull his pants down while handcuffed. This came out in court. Pull the man's pants down while handcuffed, grabbed his genitals, told him how the size of his genitals, then dry humped him. I said that it came out in court that Deadman dry humped the man after they took him to a private house in another jurisdiction. I mean, you wouldn't believe it if you saw it in a movie, but I'm imagining it'll be that one day. In Mississippi, I got to say this. We have a Department of Justice Civil Rights Division that is headed by a black woman, and Kristen Clark takes her job seriously, and her Southern Division attorneys have pursued and made history in this area. And Judge Thomas Lee, they thought that Judge Thomas Lee down here in Mississippi would not do justice. And oh, how he has set a standard and put police officers on notice all over America that if you do the crime, you're going to do the time, just like anybody else.
Well, I just want to say, Eddie Terrell Parker, you and Michael Corey Jenkins, amazingly brave and coming forward and describing what happened to you, which seems to have broken open all of these investigations right now. I want to thank civil rights attorney Malik Shabazz and Trent Walker with Black Lawyers for Justice and Eddie Parker, who was tortured by the Goon Squad. Thank you so much joining us from Jackson, Mississippi. And that does it for our show. Very happy belated birthday to Tammy Warrenoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.